Okay, we're going to start a little bit early because you're all here. So you're all so lovely and punctual, so thank you very much for coming. And yes, we've got extra time to chat. So I'm Catherine Lana and this is Browsers Bookshop, so we're really thrilled that you're all here today and that we've got Erin to speak to us about her new book. I'm going to be chatting with Erin for about 40 minutes and then there's the opportunity for questions, general questions, so do think about what you might like to ask. And then of course we'll have our books signed at the end and there'll be a bit more time for chatting as well. So we're here to promote, to launch Stone Mothers. So that's the new book and it's your seventh?
It's my seventh book, yeah.
Right. So how did we get to this point? How did you start?
I don't know. I do sometimes, I'm writing book number 8 now, and I do sometimes feel astonished that that anybody let me leave some one novel, let alone 8. So I began, I can't remember a time when I didn't want to write, and I can't remember a time when I didn't want to write exciting books. And if I sign your book later this evening, you'll see that my signature has been something I've been practicing since I was about 7. It's modelled on Enid Blyton's book. You know, she always used to have that very distinctive signature at the top. So the E of Erin, I used to do everything I could, and I used to sign it with little 2 dashes underneath. I've let that one go now. But I can't remember a time when I didn't hope that books would be what I did with my life somehow. And I thought I probably would have been an English teacher or a lecturer or something in that vein, but I had, and I didn't come from the kind of background where people wrote books, but I did have a cousin who was a journalist, and I mentioned once when I was a student that I can't think of anything I'd love to do more with my life than write books, and she said, oh, why don't you just become a journalist? So much easier, it opens loads of doors, and she said that as though a career in journalism was just as easy as knocking on Lord Rothermere's door and saying, please, could you make me editor of the Mail? And that took a long time to establish, and but all I wanted to do was write books, and I wanted to write the kind of books that I loved reading. And when I was a teenager, so Agatha Christie was, for every crime writer, she's always the gateway drug. She's the origin story of everyone who's ever written any kind of suspense fiction. So she kicked it all off when I was about 12. I remember there was a shelf in Hornchurch Library in Essex. And if I went and one of the Christies that I hadn't read was already being borrowed, I would go to the counter and I would demand, you know, when's this coming back? Who's got the body in the library? Don't they know that that's the next one in my line? And she led me on to Ruth Rendell and Daphne du Maurier and Patricia Highsmith. And I still think of Rendell, Highsmith and du Maurier as the holy trinity of my inspiration. And The Secret History, Brideshead Revisited, lots of these stories, usually with a theme of mystery but quite literary as well. And always with something I can't leave alone. And so there seem to be certain stories that are imprinted in certain writers. And for me, it's the idea of some kind of past coming back. Sometimes a long buried past, sometimes a very recent past. But the idea of what happens to us when we're young being the thing that defines us and the way we move away from those. I mean, in my case, it's usually got a body count. But in all my favourite books, it's about the person we are when we're young. There's a very brief window where nobody's in charge of us and we are not in charge of anybody else. Yeah. And those are the years that I find very interesting and they're the ones I keep returning to. So 10 years after I decided to become a journalist, I started taking writing fiction more seriously and I joined a couple of writing groups. I did a very bad course at the City Lit in London where the tutor just put lipstick on and encouraged us all to breathe from the diaphragm as we read aloud, but there were about 50 of us in one of her and it was 40 minutes long, so nobody had got to read anything. And then I got pregnant in 2008 and I knew that it was kind of now or never, so I wrote the book that eventually became The Poison Tree, and it was the easiest book I've ever written because it had, and I thought it would always be like this, I had a lifetime inspiration behind me and I didn't know what I was doing, and that meant it just came, it was like laying an egg, it came out fully formed. And now the more I know about the craft, the more nervous I am. I have more fear now about starting a new book than I did when I'd never done it before, which is a bit depressing, really.
So the Poison Tree. Then how did you feel when that came out? Because that is quite a big step, isn't it? Going from the journalism side of things to having a fully fledged novel there, and having readers. So what was the whole experience like for getting that.
Well, it wasn't an easy one to publish, actually. So lots of big milestones in my career that you would think are a cause of celebration have always been preceded by so much doubt that when it happens, the feeling is always relief rather than joy.
Yeah.
Which isn't to say that that relief is really exquisite, but I wrote this book not thinking about market. So when I started writing it in 2007, actually, not 2008, if I had been writing for what was fashionable, if I'd been writing to the market, I would have written a book about vampires or erotica, or I would maybe have combined vampires and erotica, because back then that was the books that were topping the charts were kind of quite supernatural and dark, but not necessarily realistic. And I just wrote the book that I wanted to write. And when I took it to publishers, when I finally, for a start, it took me a long time to get an agent. Whenever you read an interview with an author in the papers and they say, I sent my book out and by 12 o'clock the next day I had 14 offers and they were all fighting over me. Well, for a start, this happened before everyone had a Kindle, so I had to do it the old-fashioned way, which was to print out the first 40 pages of my manuscript and then wait and see if anybody wanted the rest. And I mean, these days, if you're writing, you can email every agent in London your manuscript on the same day, but you know, it's expensive to print out. I had to go to the copy shop, it's 20 quid a go, so I would only email three or four agents at a time, and I would love to say they were fighting over me, but I just had nothing back, and I thought, well, this is the end of that. And and I kept writing, thinking, you know, it's not quite finished, but maybe one day someone will call. And somebody did call when I was just about to have the baby. And she took me around various publishers, and they all said, and if you think about it now, psychological thrillers are everywhere. There are too many psychological thrillers now, really, because there have been so many successful ones. And I shouldn't be saying that because it's my own genre. But there have been so many successful ones that there are a lot of copycats out now. But this wasn't the situation 10 years ago. And so we took the book was called Heartwood at the time, and I remember the first editor saying, well, we're not going to publish that because it sounds like a home that does palliative care. So, it ended up being The Poison Tree, just taken from the Blake poem, just because part of it is set in a wood. But they all said the same thing. All the publishers said, we don't know how we can sell this book because it's like women's fiction because it has a love story and it has a friendship between two women and that's at the heart of it. But we can't market it as women's fiction because of the dead bodies. And we can't sell it as crime fiction because it's too well written for crime fiction and it's very literary and that will slow some readers down. You know, if they're expecting bam, 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 super pacey, the way you use language and the fact that you linger over your story and you have a long fuse, so that's going to put off the crime people. And we can't sell it as literary fiction because it's got a plot. And so it was, you know, it was backhanded compliments. They were all telling me they loved the book, but they didn't know what to do with it. And now, of course, in the wake of The Girl on the Train and Gone Girl and Before I Go to Sleep, now, if you look at what a psychological thriller is, it is the overlap in the Venn diagram between women's fiction, literary fiction and crime. It has elements of suspense. Hopefully it has the care for character that you would find in literary fiction and some careful writing. Hopefully there's an emphasis on relationships because you're writing about crime, but it's not a police officer or a forensic psychologist or somebody who comes into crime every day. So it's going to be relationship driven. So my first experience was, we love your book, but we're not going to publish it. So when I finally did get that book deal, it was just relief.
Yeah.
And every time one is, and sometimes there's, you know, sometimes it's disappointment. Sometimes a book is published and the reviews aren't what you hoped, or the sales are disappointing. But whenever a big landmark life changer happens, it's always, oh, thank goodness.
Yeah.
I got away with it again. Okay, it's fine, we're good for another book.
So that was the first one. And the last one, before Stone Mothers, was He Said, She Said, which had quite a response to that. I mean, it was phenomenal, the response to that book, wasn't it? I mean, it's quite an unusual book in itself, quite a difficult subject. So how did that take you?
Yeah, I was happily surprised by the reaction to that one. I've been told more than once it's an unusual book, but that, it didn't feel like that when I was writing it. So if you haven't read the book, it is set in the world of eclipse chasers, people whose hobby is to travel the world and witness, I mean, there's a clue in the name. They, wherever there's a total solar eclipse, whether this is in a desert or up a mountain or in a city centre, they will go there and they will stay there and they will connect with other eclipse chasers. They will hope for a clear sky and they will observe this incredible phenomenon. And years ago, I'd read about these, and there's a part of my brain, I always like to think it exists just behind the left ear, where sometimes I'll read something in passing and I'll think, I'll have you one day. I also do this with people, by the way, so be very careful. Don't tell me any secrets later, because you will end up in a novel one day. But this Eclipse Chasers, that was tucked away here in this part of my head. And I thought, one day, wouldn't that be a great premise for a suspense novel? There is a community and you all meet together, but in times and places that were preordained when the universe was formed. Isn't that an extraordinary thing? So that had been on the back burner for a while. And as with all my books, nothing ever really comes together until two separate ideas crash into each other. And I had also wanting, in a very different kind of inspiration, for a long time I had been wanting to write about the way we try sex crimes in this country. I'd been noticing that frequently, when a man is convicted of rape, reports in the press will focus not on the ordeal of his victim, but on the opportunities no longer available to him because of his conviction. And I was quite cross about that. And I used to, every now and then an email would come around saying, you know, from a female friend saying, I'm going to share this with you. Here are ways to stop yourself getting dragged into an alleyway and murdered at night. And I thought, are the men being told not to murder the women, or are the women being told not to get themselves raped and murdered? And I just was, you know, I just noticed the dialogue around this was just very one-sided. And if only we spent as much time and money and effort to, and of course not all men, of course most men not, but you know, one is enough, one is too many. And I wanted to put this into a novel. And one day I was out walking near where I live in Barnet in North London, and there was a power cut. And the plunge into darkness was so sudden and so frightening that I expected there to be a scream. And just because that's what you think about light and darkness, scary things happen in the dark. Well, there wasn't a scream, fortunately. And at that moment, the idea of something terrible happening to a woman in the dark and something, you know, the darkness, the unexpected darkness of a total eclipse, they came together, and that was the germ of what then became the book. The book is about a couple who witnessed what they believed to be an assault in the moments after an eclipse. And I did some research and I realised, having never witnessed an eclipse, I realised that actually it's not like switching off a light. It's a very gradual darkness. It's much more eerie. It's almost as though twilight rushes at you. It's very supernatural almost, and you can understand why ancient people used to think that it was the end of the world or that it was a sign from the gods. And I realised when I came to research the other half of the book that sexual assault doesn't work like that either. It's much more, the response is much more likely to be freezing than screaming. And the book went from there, really. And I now know a lot about the English judiciary and the intricacies of the court system. And I also know a lot about total eclipses. And I think I'm safe to say that this is the first place they were ever combined. And so there were two things I hadn't written about before. And I also thought, you know, I mentioned that psychological thrillers are now, having gone from being something that was hard to get published, it's now actually quite hard to choose one because there are so many on the shelves. And I knew that I needed a point of differentiation. And a psychological thriller is just a euphemism for murder mystery, a good old-fashioned whodunit. And I thought, well, you know, we've got a lot of dead bodies. Why don't I stop the whodunit and turn this into a did he do it? Who's lying? And it was just, I was aware even then, this is 3 years ago, 4 years ago even, that I was writing this. I was aware even then that it was becoming harder and harder to have a point of differentiation in this genre. So that's what I tried to do. And this time it worked.
Well, yeah. It was a great success. I mean, was it 12 weeks in the top 10 for the Sunday Times?
Yes, and I'd gone from no weeks over a 6-year career to 12, so it was very welcome. Actually, that was a lovely thing, because my publishers behind the scenes were gunning for that, but I didn't really know that. And then I do remember being told that I had a Sunday Times bestseller, and just doing that for about 30 seconds, just unable to process it. Very so that exciting. Was a moment of pure joy, not relief. Yeah.
So, the new book then.
Yes.
You talked about doing some research, extensive research for He Said, She Said. So, and this book you have researched, but how did the idea, how did that the germ for this book start off before you even did all the investigating to flesh it out?
Well, it was a friend of mine who went on a really ill-advised internet date. She was, I had a newborn baby at the time. This is how long it takes me to write a book. The child is now six. I had a baby at the time, and she was ringing me. She was going on lots of dates because she was single, and I was as unsingle as it was possible to be. And she'd ring me and tell me about her dates, you know, just to entertain me while I was feeding my baby in front of cops with cameras or whatever high-minded TV I'd be watching that day. And she said, I've just been on the most amazing date. And I said, tell me about the guy. And she said, oh, no, I won't be seeing him again. And I said, but you said it was an amazing date. She said, yeah, it was a brilliant day out. And he was an urban explorer. And he had taken her to a disused mental hospital in Kent, which was due to be developed into luxury flats, as every public building eventually built between Victorian times and now will be. I mean, I'm sure it's the same here, where, you know, the grammar school, the hospital, the police station, the water cooling tower, anywhere that was once a stunning Victorian public institution is now three flats with some Lexuses parked outside it. She told me all these stories. She said it was really interesting. We went through, and she said it was like a 4-minute warning had gone off. It didn't feel like somewhere that had, you know, when the asylums were closed and care in the community was introduced, it was supposed to be a very ordered process. But actually what happened very frequently was that a property developer came in and made an NHS trust an offer that they couldn't refuse and that would build a new institution that was fit for purpose. And let's not be romantic about it, they're very impressive architecturally, but the Victorian mental hospitals are, you know, were not fit for purpose almost as soon as they were bought. They hadn't considered things, you know, one of the main things you need to do in a hospital full of vulnerable people is think about sight lines and make sure there are no corners where people can go and harm themselves or worse. Helen's date, she was telling me about it, and she said, so there were sort of slippers still under the bed, and there was a Dick Francis novel out face down with somebody's reading glasses still on top of it. She said it was just the most eerie thing. And there
so,
were.
So how long had it been closed for then?
About a year. But in that year, it, you know, the ivy was already reclaiming the building, and there were staircases that you couldn't climb because the stairs had already rotted because the roof was gone. And but one of the things she found was a filing cabinet, and she opened the filing cabinet and she saw patient records going back to the 1970s, and these were records of incredibly ill, incredibly vulnerable people. And you would have thought that the first priority, before you start thinking about selling off the lead piping and the fireplaces and all the stuff that you can make a profit on, you would have thought that the administrator's first priority would be to preserve the anonymity of these incredibly vulnerable patients. Now, she works in the NHS, so she knew what to do with them. And she took these records, and where appropriate, they were archived or they were reunited with the patient in question. And she was saying, you know, what a scandal. And I was thinking, but in the wrong hands, you've got a book there. If you did something as a young person when you were unwell, or if you were wrongly committed, or if there is a piece of paper that says something untrue or incriminating about you, what would you do to stop the people you loved finding out what's on that piece of paper? And that was the birth of the story.
Right.
Yeah. So it was also the kind of date, by the way, if she told me she was going on a date to an empty, creepy hospital with a man she'd never met before, I would have told her not to go.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it sounds like the beginning of a very different kind of thing, you know, one where he's got the gas mask and the knife, and fortunately she's still alive. The reason she didn't go on another date with him was because he ate dry roasted peanuts and he licked all the coating off the peanuts and then put them in a pile, and she said it was all going really well until then. You can see why love didn't blossom. That didn't end up in the book.
No.
It might, can't
it? But it might.
Yes. Right, okay, so that was the germ of the idea. How did you then decide you were going to turn it into this book? Because it's not a complicated, well, it is complicated plot, but you
felt like that when I was writing it.
And also you're doing it, telling it backwards in time almost.
Yeah, that seemed like a good idea at the time. So luxury flats seem the obvious starting place. I also, in North London, I live near a housing development that's called Princess Park Manor, but was in its day Colney Hatch, which was quite a famous mental hospital in its time. It was the biggest one in England, and it's wider than Buckingham Palace, and it's very posh now, but I'm afraid I pretended to be interested in buying one of the flats so that I could have a look. And when you go inside, this when you think about the horrors and the atrocities that would have happened in 100 years of this building, and you go inside and they have all the character of a Barrett home, fresh out of the box. And I just thought, isn't this interesting that somewhere, you know, the whitewashing of history that happens, there was no, windows aside, you wouldn't know that you weren't living just in a kind of shoebox flat anywhere. And I thought, well, okay, I do like it. I do like a hidden past. So what if you were living in these flats now and you had a reason, something had happened to you here, but you had to keep living here and pretend that everything was normal and pretend that everything was nice. And that was the next stage. And I then I just spent 6 months in the Wellcome Library in London, where they have the history of medicine and a really fantastic history of psychiatry. Spent a lot of time on YouTube. I spent months and months trying to find out what medical records would have looked like, because the plot turns on what is written on a piece of paper, on some patient records that are very, very old. And so I was calling up retired psychiatrists, and I was asking somebody I know who works at the Maudsley, I was saying, right, who, every lecturer you ever had, please could you get in touch with them and find out what happened. And I was asking psychiatrists, you know, I understand that I wouldn't dream of asking you to break patient confidentiality, but could you mock me up an idea of, you know, here is the crime or the illness that I want this person to have committed, what would it say when they were admitted to hospital?
Mm.
And nobody would tell me. They all said, this is completely unethical, you know, which is, as a human being of morals, that's exactly what I want them to say. As a novelist, I was like, could you give me a break? But there is some stuff on YouTube. There's lots of memoirs. And actually, when I'm researching a book, I think that you can find more gold in self-published work on Kindle than you can in best-selling memoirs. Because once a story has become a bestseller, everybody owns it and everybody knows it. But there are a handful of people who were committed way, you know, quite far back in the 20th century. And their accounts would be sometimes quite garbled and badly edited, but there would be details in here that I could pick up to put together the experience of being there. There are old BBC documentaries. You know what it's like trying to find something from the BBC archives, but every now and then something would be on YouTube for a day and I'd be able to watch it before the copyright lawyers took it down again. So interviews with patients who had had lobotomies or gone through electroconvulsive therapy, sometimes who were genuinely very unwell, sometimes they had not been unwell, they'd been misunderstood. And I learned from that things about the attitude of staff and doctors and the way men and women are treated very differently historically in these institutions. But I finally found my copy of patient records in the unlikeliest source. So in South East London, they have the Bedlam Museum. It's called the Museum of the Mind, and it's from the original Bedlam Hospital in central London from the 1600s, where you would pay your penny to go and laugh at the lunatics who were chained to the staircase in manacles and maybe throw some fruit at them for a giggle. And then, of course, the Victorians hoped that they were reforming all of this. But it's a very interesting history of psychiatry, and we see the way that drugs changed, the way that mechanical treatments changed and talking therapies. But one exhibit is absolutely fascinating. Spike Milligan was very open about his mental illness throughout his life, and he decided to waive his patient anonymity and make public for that museum his own patient records. So what I was actually after was something that had examples of sort of historic misogyny or a woman's experience. But he wrote a diary and he made available the doctor's notes and his own thoughts from that time.
Mm.
And so there at last. I mean, who would have thought this guy who wrote books about funny animals that I liked to read when he was six would 35 years later unlock a book that I was writing? But yeah, it was the hardest thing to research I've ever had to do.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is how it affected you, because some of the stories are very distressing.
I get all my anger out at the research phase. So by the time I come to write it down and turn it into a book, everything that needs to be there is there, and the actual writing is quite calm. It's gathering the facts. That's the point at which I start to feel a bit like I'm on a crusade. But I've also got to watch that as well. You've got to be very careful as a writer, I think, not to... It's one thing to have an opinion in a novel and have an attitude and not make it bland, but what you don't want is for your politics to cloud a novel so much that it becomes a soapbox and people feel preached at. Ideally, well, above all, you want a page-turning story with believable characters, and if a message leaks through that, so much the better. But I am aware that I am a woolly liberal from London, and that if that's my starting point, then my books turn into sermons and not novels. And I've got to be, you know, as whatever your politics, you've got to be careful that the story comes first and that the message you've just got to trust that the message will leak out through the way you've written the book.
So how do you hope that people will respond to this book? And what have you heard from people who've read it already?
Well, it's such early days. I mean, it's only 6 days in the world. All I ever want is for somebody to say, you've got to read this book and pass it to a friend, which sounds like I don't necessarily... He Said, She Said was much more overtly political, and I wanted people to come away questioning their attitude. There's nothing in Stone Mothers I don't think that anybody would disagree with. There's nothing controversial in there. Mm. You will read a fictionalised account of factual treatment of mental illness, and you will read about how badly managed the deinstitutionalisation of mental health care was. But all of that is fact, and I don't want to impose a reaction, but I hope you will come away feeling sympathy for characters you felt in the early pages were unsympathetic.
Yes.
But it's not for me to, you know, your book gets born again every time somebody new reads it.
Yeah.
And I learned early on that you cannot control people's reactions. And some people will read a book completely differently. This, so Stone Mothers is set in a fictional mental hospital in Suffolk in a sort of, I basically drove around the county till I got lost. I spend a lot of time here. My mum lives in Leiston. So I know the area, but this book had to happen somewhere isolated. It had to be an islanded community. It had to be a town where it was feasible that when the main employer goes, the town is thrown into chaos. And I've seen that. I see that happen in Leiston. You know, in Leiston, unemployment is a problem. It sounds really dramatic to say this, but 3 generations later, they have still not quite recovered from the loss of the foundry there. I wanted to write about... See, I get to see the pretty tourist side, because I come here in the summer with my children, and we play in Southwold Pier, and we go to the museum, and you know, when you spend time in Leiston, you see the more vulnerable side of Suffolk. What was the question? I'm just going off on.
It's one of the questions I wanted, which was why you set it in Suffolk.
But there was a question that was leading that, and then as I was talking, I completely forgot what it was. Well, if you're still interested, I'll keep talking. that was another thing that I wanted to explore, just rural poverty and what it does. Oh, this is, I was talking about how you can't control how people interpret your novel. So Marianne, who revisits the asylum, her husband buys her a luxury flat in the asylum, and she's the one with the history there. She's the one, and Sam is her husband, and he is the one, along with her vulnerable daughter, who must not know what happened in this place when it was an abandoned building and when it was a hospital. And Marianne's fortunes are about to be overturned by her ex-boyfriend, her childhood sweetheart, Jesse, who knows everything about her. And he is the one who stayed in Suffolk while Marianne decided she was too posh and decided to go and live in London. And in Jesse, I have written my best attempt at a white British working class man who has been let down by a country that has dumped an entire generation of people by taking away industry and not giving these people anything to replace it. And he is the whitest character I have ever written. I mean, he's a blue collar, you know, his family will be, unless they were serfs, which they probably were, you know, he'll go right back to the Doomsday Book. You can make no mistake about that. And another publisher read it and said, I just thought it was fantastic. You know, you really summed up what it is to be a black man in Thatcher's Britain. And I said, what? And she said, you know, I mean, you know, the way that Jesse's race counts against him at every turn. And I never, when I describe him, I talk about, there's a moment where I say that he's so shocked that he, I think the description is something like he looks like a silent film star because his skin has gone white and his eyes and lips look so dark, he looks like he's wearing makeup. And I said, I even call him pale blue at one stage. But isn't that interesting that a reader will bring their own preconceptions and turn your novel into something that you never intended? So for her, great. She thought it was successful. There's Jesse the black man. It's all, you know. And that was her reading of it, and she didn't find fault with it. But I just thought it's once you've written the book, you have no control over. Some interpretations are mistaken. Sometimes it's an assumption. But I am the last person that you want. You said, what did I want people to think? And my point being that I want you to enjoy my book, but beyond that, I can't control anything. Ask me another question. I'll see if I can actually answer the actual question.
So did you answer the thing about Suffolk then? So you drove around lots of places to get lost because you wanted to see something that was a bit different, so not the touristy side of things. So how did you plot, how did you locate your asylum in Suffolk?
I drove to the Norfolk border. So I drove to this because I wanted to write about Fenland, and I wanted there to be, you know, you can't build on the fens, so, and most of the fens are out on the borders that are in Suffolk, and I wanted this place to be literally islanded. I wanted there to be a natural moat, because the story turns, and some of the things that happen in this hospital, my characters need to not be able to get away. So, you know, I put a fen here and a rainstorm there and a fallen tree in the garden. that was part of it, but I wanted to write, the poison tree is set partly in Suffolk as well, and I wanted to write about a place I love and a place I know, and I just thought, well, I'll keep going, because, you know, Layston's not disconnected enough, and I just kept going until, I probably trespassed quite a lot with the car, I wasn't quite driving through crops at any stage, but, you know, I kept going until I got lost. And when I could stand and not see a telegraph pole or a person for miles and miles, I thought, here is where I shall build my imaginary hospital.
And how, well, you said that it's very new out there, really, but finding an asylum that you could base it on, do people want it to be based on something true?
Well, that's where it had to depart from the way that Suffolk actually did look after its mentally ill. So we're quite near here, aren't we, to St Audrey's?
Mm.
St Aubrey's? Audrey's?
Audrey's.
Which I believe is now luxury flats, or luxury, yes, or posh housing, yeah. Proving my point. But that's actually more of a cottage hospital. You know, the architecture there isn't the big, intimidating, vast stone mother. Oh, the title of the book, by the way, should be the first thing I told you. Stone Mothers was the name the Victorians gave to their mental hospitals. They were, at the time, they were these incredibly modern institutions. Everything they thought they knew about caring for the mentally unwell. If you look at the floor plan, they are designed, you know, with beds laid out to a certain... They had done these calculations based on their observations. You mustn't be on your own, because that's scary, unless you need to be secluded. But you mustn't be too close, because we need fresh air. Here is the laundry where some of you'll work. Here is the garden where you'll work, if that's appropriate for you. You can shower in this way. There's hydrotherapy rooms here. They were designed as buildings to nurse ill people back to life. And they were vast palaces, you know, they were huge. These hospitals were built to contain an entire county. Well, the population of Suffolk means that St Audrey's was never going to... If you were really bonkers in the olden days, they sent you to Fulbourn in Cambridge. And I suppose that would have been the true serving hospital for East Anglia. So I fudged it so that in my book we're kind of on the Norfolk border, and I said that the whole of East Anglia would have been taken to the fictional Nusted Hospital. But what's very interesting about the Victorian hospital, well, I think it is that very soon after they were built, of course, something happened. Most of them were completed in the 1890s, and 20-odd years after that, something happened to overturn everything we understood about human trauma, which was, of course, the First World War. Mm. And for the first time, shell shock was a phenomenon, and we had an entire generation of traumatised men and bereaved women and missing people. And so almost from the moment they were built, these hospitals were understood to be obsolete. You know, it was understood that what you needed was clean lines and sight lines, and that, you know, actually putting somebody in a basement with a copper and telling them to boil sheets covered in poo wasn't necessarily a way to cure mental illness. So for most of their lives, these hospitals have not been fit for purpose, whether they ever were, you know, as our understanding of psychiatry changes. Was that an answer to your question?
I think so.
Yeah.
But the other aspect of it is people who were put into these places who shouldn't have been in the places. And that is something that I think we're all still so shocked about, because you still keep hearing things. You know, it's not that long ago that it happened. So how did you uncover that, and how did you use that for the plot?
So it's not unwritten about before. I mean, it's almost a subgenre of literature in itself about the... Wilkie Collins, The Woman in White, I suppose, is the original asylum novel. Our narrator, who is, no spoilers here, The Woman in White, who appears in a graveyard, may or may not have been an asylum, may or may not have been there correctly. But it's as... Oh, and Sarah Waters' Fingersmith as well, I think, is the pinnacle of asylum fiction. About two women who essentially... one tricks another into being committed so that once she's out of the way, we can have all her money. And, you know, this is... And the reason it's a staple of fiction is because it happened again and again and again. And I think about 6 months ago, it emerged that Charles Dickens had tried to have his wife sent away because after bearing him all his many children, she'd got a bit old and squishy. And he had his eye on, you know, some sort of sexy bar wench or something. So it happened again and again. And I knew that. What I wasn't prepared for was how recently this was still happening. So there was a law passed in 1959 that made things a lot better. But before 1959... all you needed was, if you were a man under the age of reason, or you were a woman of any age, all you needed was a signature from your father or your brother or your husband. And if you were an inconvenient woman, you could be quietly popped away so that you wouldn't be an embarrassment. There's a parallel. You can tell by my name probably, and my face, if not my accent, that my family history is Irish. And I've always been, and one day might write about the Magdalene laundries where unmarried mothers or just difficult women were sent away. And that, so it's, you know, it's part of my folklore almost. It's a kind of national stain and something that I've known about since I was little, how lucky I was to be born when I was. But, you know, difficult women will always be, people will always try to keep difficult women quiet. And that was the way we used to do it. We have new ways now. We just bully them off Twitter instead, or shame them in other ways. But there is practices that we assume would have died out 150 years ago were still alive and kicking, well into not so much in this century, but even now, if you have a history of if you have, and this actually part of it came through my research from He Said, She Said, the alleged rape victim in He Said, She Said has a history of mental illness. She has been on antidepressants, she's been under psychiatric care, and we still treat, and this isn't women specific, but we still treat anybody who has ever had an episode of mental illness as though it is a personality trait. And once ill, you are never trustworthy again. You can't be allowed to be responsible. You can't be believed. So in that sense, we haven't moved on at all, really. But fortunately for most... And I had an episode, I had a nervous breakdown in 2013. And I was very fortunate in that I dipped a toe into it. I had a horrendous 6 months and I came out again. But I'm very aware that there is... If I were, God forbid, ever to kill someone in self-defense, you know, I'm a crime writer, I have to think along these terms. You know, you give me any situation and I just go straight to blood on the walls, worst case scenario, everyone's in prison and dead. But, you know, if I were ever involved in anything where my word mattered in a court of law, somebody would be able to wheel out, well, what about this time you went to the doctor and said you couldn't feel your feet, you know? What about that time you were on a very strong dose of amitriptyline so that you could do the school run? And it's, you know, I'm just very aware that once your card is marked, there it is. And even one-off episodes are often held as signs. I mean, this being crime fiction, of course, I've taken that notion and taken it further and further and further. But that was where the germ of that was.
Wow. So crime fiction, and you're now working on your next... book. What do you tell us anything about what you're working on next?
Oh my gosh, do you know, I think I'm about to do something I've never done before, and I'm possibly about to abandon a book.
No.
Yeah. Or not abandon it, but park it. So I've been working for 7 months on a novel that I just cannot unlock, and I've got my twist and my ending, and I know what happens in the middle, but I can't work out how to make the beginning exciting yet plausible. And I think I just need some time away. And while I was, and this was an idea that I don't want to talk about because I might jinx it, that I've been having for years and years. And I think, well, if I thought about it 3 years ago and I've been writing it for nearly a year and I still don't know my way in, it's just time to take a step back. But while I was getting stressed about this book, something happened that never has before. And I had, you know, J.K. Rowling famously thought up Harry Potter on the train in Edinburgh Station and wrote it all down on a napkin or something. By the time she pulled into King's Cross, she knew everything. She knew how the story, she knew how all six books were going to pan out. And I wouldn't, I mean, I would love it to be that lucrative and popular, but I very rarely have I had a germ of an idea and not had to wait for a long time. So there's this other novel that I've been quietly having an affair with in the corner, and that's the one. It's a bit like being in love. It's when I'm reading other books or listening to songs, all of the songs are about this secret novel, and I think I might start writing that one when I get home tomorrow. I don't know. But it's the one that I... Yeah, I don't know is the answer, but I've never done that before. I've never abandoned a book. And I abandon is the wrong word. Put it on the back burner. But I might be about to do that. But I just think, oh my goodness, nearly a year of...
Yeah,
writing this, but yeah, maybe I need a break.
Because that's the thing you were saying earlier about being a journalist. I mean, writing articles is such a different skill from writing a novel. For one thing, you can flip from one subject to another and move on, but novel is such an investment of time and energy. And I think you've said in the past that you usually get to halfway through and then you discover that you're having a difficulty, but you know that you can get through that halfway. So how have you coped in the past in getting through that hurdle of getting to the end of writing a book?
Just do it really slowly and cry. No, I mean, usually the thing that I know is the end, and it's the middle that sends me a bit doolally. And usually it's just dogged persistence, and I just keep putting my bottom on the chair until I do it, which is why I'm finding it very hard to differentiate. Is this just the middle of the novel where it's always like this and I always just want to pack it all in and become a Zumba instructor? Or is it actually... I don't know. I feel like this time it's a flaw with the book that maybe I'm just not in the right frame of mind to do it. Maybe it's that this other idea is taking up my attention. I don't know. But maybe the difference is actually normally I push through because I don't have a plan B. But this time I do have a plan B to get me off the hook. Maybe I'll write half of this one and then think of the way to finish the other one and come back.
Yeah.
I don't know. Either way, I've got a deadline in October, so it's all looking a bit...
The pressure's on. But you have also taught writing, creative writing. So what has that brought to you in helping others with their writing? How has it helped with your writing? Or does it? Does it hinder?
No, it makes it much worse because I said, didn't I, when I was writing The Poison Tree, I didn't know what I was doing, so it was pure instinct. And I think as you write more and more novels, it necessarily has to become more about craft because, you know, you do find out what you're doing and you learn practically. I still haven't really read, apart from Stephen King's memoir, any books on how to write a book. I worked it out by reading other people and then by doing it. But, when I was teaching, I had to step back and analytically think about what I was doing. And I used my own books as the source material. And I would think, so why did I change viewpoint here? And why did I decide that this one... So, for example, He Said, She Said has two narrators. Why did I decide that I would chop and change here rather than giving them great big stretches? And why with Stone Mothers did I decide that I would go backwards in big chunks? So one decade, another decade, another decade. All of these... I questioned everything and I went over it, and spending lots of time editing other people's work just meant that my inner editor was firing on all cylinders. So now I'm a lot less likely to just kind of blurt things out because I'll already know, well, that's not going to work. So I actually do find it quite inhibiting. But I loved teaching. I absolutely loved it up until a point when I suddenly didn't. And I think I just had, I teach 15 students at a time, and you can't carry 15 other novels in your head and work on your own at the same time. And for a little while I could, and then all of a sudden I was just full up of them and their books, and I realised the idea was, because it's such a ridiculously insecure profession, so I thought, well, you've got to do something on the side. No one can live, very few people can live on only what they make from books. And I realised that there was a point where I'd gone from being a novelist who occasionally taught to being a teacher who used to write novels, and that's when I decided to stop.
And what do you think about courses generally, the value of them? Because as you were saying, that you entered it and you were writing instinctively, but it is quite a big area now of
well, it's a huge area. And when I was starting out, the choice of courses were you either did a master's, you moved to Norwich and did the master's at UEA, or you did little tiny courses like the one that I did. I did the one at City Lit. I did was 6 weeks on a Wednesday lunchtime, and it was too crowded, and it wasn't really a course. It was a chance to listen to people and maybe get your work looked at once in a 6 weeks period. And fair enough, because it was £90. So what did I really expect for that kind of money? And actually, I think what it was good for me, because it gave me a deadline. And it gave me a reason to start writing stuff. Same for my writing group. It wasn't really useful critically, but for me, it was a framework to stop saying one day you're going to be a novelist and actually take the first steps. And you can't instill talent. If somebody can't write, a course will not turn them into a great writer. What you can do is instill craft and discipline and structure and framework. So the place I used to teach, I do the kind of one-offs for the Guardian masterclasses, but the place I used to teach was called Curtis Brown Creative, and it's a big academy, 15 students twice a year. And out of that 15 students, we would all introduce ourselves in the beginning. Usually two, I would think, well, you're golden. Mm. You will get published, and I'm always right. Bar one or two. A couple are still writing. They have agents, but not necessarily book deals, but they will get there. Three or four, I will think, there's talent, but you need me. And they were the students I loved working with. Because so the two who were going to be fine anyway, I would just think, well, you've just wasted £3,000 because you've already finished your book and it's fantastic and you will get there. Mm. You know, you'll have a peer group and you'll have me and you'll have a few more contacts, but really, you're fine. There would always be three or four, and I think, well, you might, because you're talented enough, but either you haven't read enough of the genre you're writing in, or maybe you're a bit cocky and you don't think you need to be edited, or maybe you don't have the confidence in your own. And they were the ones I used to love teaching. And the rest, I'm afraid, I would think, well, it's been lovely getting to know you, but and that is the odds. I mean, that's a cross section of society. Everybody can write, as in everybody can type sentences, but not everybody will make it. And then of those few who do make it, only a tiny percentage of them will sustain a career in it. But personality type has as much to do with it as literary talent. I know so many people who can craft stunning sentences and they've got ideas firing off, but they can't handle the solitude. Mm. You need to be a self-starter. You need to be a bit of a misanthropist, really. You need to be quite happy that you're going to spend most of your time on your own with imaginary friends who will be doing terrible things, who won't do what you want them to do. And you also need, I think being a freelance journalist was incredibly useful training. I've only ever spent 15 months of my life with a salary. So I had a job for 15 months when I started out as a journalist, and I was freelance after that. So I am used to the idea that when money comes in, you just park it and you don't spend it. And that's a big part of it. There are people who will never be writers, or they will never have a career in writing because they'll get a debut, they'll blow it, they'll never do it again because they can't, you know. And some people only have one book in them. So it's personality type and doggedness, and you have to have exactly the right kind of ego. That's an incredibly fragile thing. You must need to think, well, what I have is good enough to share with the world. But you also have to be sensitive enough to absorb what's going on around you to make you a good writer. But then you have to be insensitive enough that bad reviews bounce off you and that you understand that it's a wheel and you'll have terrible years and good years. I don't advise it. It's a terrible way to live.
Well, I'm sure we're all very glad that you have done so far. Has anybody got any questions that they'd like to ask at this point? Yes, hi.
You mentioned your children. How do you balance writing with bringing up two small people?
The way that men have always done it. My husband doesn't work. but it is, even within those parameters, it is very hard. It's the Easter holidays at the moment, and let's just say there's a reason I'm in Suffolk, not London, because they can't get to me from here. They post letters under the door saying, when will you finish? And quite recently the 5-year-old took apart a necklace and bead by bead put it on. I need to get the gap in my study door fixed is really the lesson we can take away from this. But yeah, so I mean, the flippant answer is that my husband does the practical stuff, but it's a challenge. And I know lots of women whose husbands are the earners who are really struggling to carve out that time. And there's lots of, I know some people who are doing it with 5 a.m. starts 3 days a week, which is all well and good, but if your child is also having a 5 a.m. start, that's not great, is it? So, yeah.
So what's your routine then? What's your writing routine?
When my children are at school,
yeah,
I'm writing. But where having a spouse at home helps is that I can do things like this. And it's not the actual writing that makes that much of a difference, because I find that I don't write that much over the holidays anyway. I mean, you need some time off, but it's the promotion and the publicity and the fact that I can, if I need to, go to, you know, I went to Edinburgh last month. I'm all over the country for the next 6 weeks, and that's brilliant and I love it, but I couldn't do it if he had a proper job. Yeah.
And how do you find the promotion of the books? Is that something you enjoy, or...?
It's lovely on an evening like this when people actually turn up and are engaging, but, you know, sometimes it can be... sometimes you can find yourself 5 hours on a train to go to a local library where it's one person, they're only there for heating, you know. And, but when it, yeah, I enjoy it. I enjoy talking about books. I enjoy meeting readers,
yeah,
and I enjoy finding out what other people are reading. And I've never really had any better, you know, apart from if people do. I mean, I was once flown to Southern California and nobody turned up. That was pretty bleak. Because the... my talk was booked well in advance, and then the local college or high school football team or something got through to a final that nobody ever expected them to go to. So as I was going in, it was in La Jolla, and it was like a zombie movie. We were the only car on the streets, and there was nobody there at all. And yeah, they were watching. I can't even remember what sport it was, but let me tell you, La Jolla was on lockdown that night. The only people who were out were in a sports bar. And so I had a room laid out like this in the bookshop, and there was one person there, and then I found out towards the very end she called the bookshop owner mum. And I realised even she had been drafted in, so that was it. But everyone's got stories like that. Every author, you know, there's a story, there's an urban myth going around of the author who had exactly that experience, one person who fell asleep in the reading and then turned out to be dead. And I've heard this from so many... it's too good to be true, but I've heard it from so many sources. You actually know the person it happened to, but you do wonder how much that is. But it's fun. I really enjoy events as well when I'm talking to other authors, when there's three or four of us up,
yeah,
and then not so much all focused on me. And that's... But it's also a treat, you know, to... I said I've got the kind of personality that lets me sit at home on my own. But sometimes it doesn't really feel real until you see something like that. You see books, yeah, lined up on a stand, and
yeah,
then it actually feels, oh yeah, I did do that. And actually the brilliant thing about seeing the book there is that you never have to write it again. I just think it's bound now. It's a book, it's out in the world. Nobody can ask me to edit it or research it, you know, nothing else.
Yeah.
You know, of course I've got to do it once a year for the rest of my life. But it's kind of like a treat for having done all the work in lots of ways.
And the cover, sorry, I'll stop asking questions in a minute, but the cover, how did that come about?
I love that cover, and I don't always. Most of the time when you see a cover, so my publisher's always saying, oh, you're on the literary side of Crime Erin, and then you see the cover and it's like a pair of headlights and someone going, ah! And you go, no, it's not, it's just a load of genre nonsense. But actually, and so usually there's a debate with my cover. I always think they're too commercial. They always think they have to be super commercial to get them into the supermarkets, but this time I looked at it and just loved it from the beginning. It's so the way it's laid out now, it looks like two eyes. Mm-hmm. On its own it looks like a shell, and then you get further in and you realise it's a spiral staircase, which is crucial to the plot. And if you kind of half close one eye, they start moving around, which is not great if you're a vertigo sufferer like, yeah, I am. But, yeah,
but it's it does. It's drawing you in deeper, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But I love it. I've never been that happy with a cover before. But the author rarely has much say in how a book is presented, because the cover is a marketing tool. Mm. It's about making somebody pick up a book, whether that's at this level, somebody in a bookshop, or it's the all-powerful Tesco's book buying board who make decisions like that that ruin lives. So yeah. I'm being flippant, but no, the way the supermarkets do have extraordinary power over whether a book becomes a bestseller or not, and which is why we must all do. I mean, I boycott everywhere but my local bookshop and a site called Hive I sometimes buy through. But yeah, it's an incredibly tough marketplace. And you can tell that I'm bitter because Stone Mothers didn't make the supermarkets after all, even despite the lovely colour cover. So.
Oh,
I know, idiots. Unfortunately, you can't boycott supermarkets altogether. That's quite awkward.
Anyway, okay. Any other questions? Yes.
Do you? Is everything in your head, or do you write yourself notes, or do you dictate into a machine with all your ideas? And do you do bullet points and then think how you're going to join them all together, or how do you work?
It's honestly different for every book. I wish I could dictate, but I don't seem to be able to, not least because I've always got RSI in this shoulder, and I'd love to be able to spare that. But I carry it in my head for as long as I possibly can, because the longer I can let it gestate in its an imaginary form, then the more momentum there is behind it when I write. But usually, I don't write chronologically, I write in scenes that I find very interesting. So I will write a scene at a time, and then I will think, well, that scene needs something to foreshadow it, and then what happened after that one? And usually the only time I write in longhand is when I'm stuck. So most of it's done on the laptop.
Yeah.
And then when I'm stuck, then the spider diagrams come out on me. But I certainly don't have, I know some authors use an Excel spreadsheet to plot timelines and who's where and check everybody's the right age, and some people write incredibly detailed synopses before they even begin the proper business of writing. Jeffrey Deaver has a synopsis of something like 110 pages, which to my mind is a first draft. But it's different for everybody. But generally it's scenes, and then I connect those scenes, and it's the connective tissue. But finding, and sometimes I write scenes that will never end up in the book. I remember when I wrote The Poison Tree, which is about many things, but one of the things is it's about a brother and sister, very bohemian brother and sister, who kind of adopt a more naive student. And I knew that Karen, the naive student, had to transfer her affections from the sister to the brother at some stage, and it stopped being an incredibly intense friendship and it became a love affair. And I just couldn't see, because the sister was so charismatic and the brother really wasn't, and I couldn't see how they would get together, so I thought, well, I'll just put them in bed. So I wrote a little scene, and I thought, well, what they chat about on the pillow? And I did. I just put them in bed together and wrote a little scene, and then I understood what it was that they found attractive about each other. They never made it into the book, but sometimes you just write a little tiny scene that will help you understand why you're doing what you're doing, and then a new scene will come from that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. I just wondered, because your books are sort of suspense and crime, have you ever been tempted, or have you ever had an idea that sort of switches genre at all?
Yeah, I have. I would like to write a funny book. I've got an idea for a kind of funny mum book, but no one wants to pay me to write a funny mum book. I've also, what I do find is that I'm naturally drawn to quiet, more literary books, and then I look at them as they stand and I think, by now people want suspense from me, so that's what I'll give them. And I think I'm quite good at it, and I think I will do that, but I would love to get to a point where I had enough security to take a year off and just write something not knowing it had to be suspenseful. I mean, I will always be a fan of the plot. All my favourite authors, Sarah Waters, Ian McEwan, you know, they have big thumping plots, and that will always be the kind of book I write. But I would like to, I mean, I think it's debatable whether some of my books are even crime fiction anyway, even though they're kind of twisty and tenny. But I would once like to write a book where nobody dies, yeah. Got such a body count these days, it's terrible.
Got more questions?
I've recently become addicted to BookTube. Do you watch it, or, like, I think you were supposed to meet Richard Savage?
Oh, Simon Savage, yeah.
So, do you watch BookTube? Or
no.
No.
Because it's... I'd feel a bit like a chicken at Nando's. Because if you're constantly watching other people dissect and review books, if you think too much about how you're viewed from the outside, it can make you so self-conscious that you just stop writing altogether. So I don't look at my Amazon reviews, I don't go on Goodreads. My publishers will send me good reviews and they will hide bad ones from me. But it can be, I think BookTube and Goodreads and Amazon reviews are brilliant. I'm very full of them. I think they're brilliant for reading communities. But as an author, one bad comment can knock your confidence for a week, and I just haven't got time to think about how it appears from the outside like that. Yeah, no, I can't.
It's a newfound addiction.
Just okay, well, you do you. You go for it, but just don't make me sit and watch it next to you.
Anything else? Yes.
Yeah, I was really interested in your writing about mental health.
Mm.
I wondered if you'd ever read Janet Frame, because I've read a lot of her lately.
Yeah.
She seems to me the ultimate in...
Yeah, so Janet Frame, she's New Zealand, isn't
New Zealand,
she?
Yeah.
I read every memoir about women in mental health that I could get my hands on. So I read Faces in the Water, which is her brilliant account. I mean, it's almost like a sort of prose poem, as well as being just a very interesting account. In my humble opinion, it's better than The Bell Jar, which is always held up as the standard of madness literature. Yeah, I read a lot of Janet Frame. Faces in the Water, though, I think is the one.
Yeah, I just read
for me.
Song,
And I read a book called The Ha Ha. I can't remember who that's by. I want to say Jenny something, and that's about somebody being committed in the 60s, I think. Yeah. I read all the memoirs I could get my hands on. Some self-published, as I said, and they are always very rambling and weird, but there will always there's something you can use in every book. There's always something there.
Yes.
Have you read anything about Vivian Elliott?
No.
You know Tom T.S. Eliot, his wife?
No.
Oh.
Why, did he send her bonkers as well?
She was certainly committed.
Right. So we've got to look at what the common factor there is, isn't it, haven't we?
she had...
Don't marry a poet.
It's a sad story, though.
Yeah.
You know,
no, I don't know that.
Because she is credited with writing some of his best work, or at least helping with it.
Okay.
And having put her away, he didn't have to give her any credit whatsoever.
I will look this up. This is the kind of story I live for. In fact, one of the book that I might be writing, the one that I'm secretly having an affair with, is about artists, couples who are artists, where that might be...
Oh.
I'm saying no more.
Yes.
In the true spirit of suspense, I make you wait 5 years for the book, which is the rate I'm going at the moment. But that's very interesting. I will investigate.
She had very, difficulty with periods and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that difficulty manifested itself in her mental illness.
Yeah.
But anyway, poor woman. She had a very sad life.
Yeah. But there's a list that does the rounds every now and then of, I think it's from 1902, reasons women were committed in the early 20th century. And some of them are funny, you know, laziness and novel reading. I would have been dragged off in manacles. And then some of them just sound like a good night out, you know, excess snuff eating, wine. I think one was sort of thrice daily masturbation or something. But then you look deep down, and actually some of these women were put away through, you know, loss of child, loss of son in the war, domestic abuse, violent husband. And isn't that extraordinary? The husband's violence, the result of that is that she is then put away rather than him be removed. I can well believe it.
But then you've got the story of Rose Kennedy, You know, Rose Kennedy, JFK's sister, who, because she was kind of rather... She wasn't as bright as the others, and she was a little outrageous at parties and would say things that weren't generally approved of. And in the end, she had a lobotomy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Rose was lost forever.
Yeah. Although I would say that being... born into the Kennedys is one of those kind of curses, not a blessing in the first place, isn't it? They don't, gilded cage.
Yeah.
But one thing we haven't mentioned, though, is the support that you've got. In fact, Louisa's not a good time to leave, but because Killer Women, that was a sort of support network for all the crime writers. So can you say a little bit about how that worked and how it's grown?
Yeah, so Killer Women, I think now there are 22 of us, and we are all women and we all write crime in its many guises. So we've got some quite hard-boiled detectives, and we've got, we're not detectives, I'm talking about our books, not us, some historical crime fiction, lots of psychological thrillers, some police procedurals, a forensic psychiatrist book, and it was the brainchild of Lou, who's just vanished to catch her train, and Mel McGrath, and they just thought, why don't we it was done in the in response to the fact that we get a very small window of time that we get support from our publishers to plug our book. So I've got 6 weeks at the moment for this hardback because it's new, and then my publisher needs to look after somebody else, and their budget goes there, which is as it should be. You know, I like to think I'm the only book they publish, but they certainly wouldn't have those fancy offices if they were only relying on me. And we thought, well, let's do stuff where if there are 20 of us and we organise all the events, there will always be someone who's available to do it. And it was just a way of keeping our books visible year round, because we get this tiny, tiny window, and the rest of the time you might as well not exist. So, and we run a festival in London, and we have just launched a mentoring scheme to get women from ethnic minority backgrounds and low-income writing, because they're both, you know, publishing is full of middle-class white birds, basically. And we need to make, you know, we need to do what we can to reach out to other communities. And we also, you know, sometimes we just get together for a drink and a whinge, and it's just a lovely thing.
Mm.
But I can't take, all I do is turn up to the meetings and say, yes, I'll do that.
Yeah. Right, well.
Do you let self-published writers into Killer Women?
We haven't. We did have Helen Smith was part of our gang for a long time, and she was shortlisted
for the Selfies Award.
Oh, congratulations. Helen was, I think, hybrid rather than self-published. So, and Rachel Abbott's recently joined, who's traditionally published now, but certainly made her...
She was wonderful last October.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed
Yeah, she scene. Was... I think when she came to us, she was, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But membership isn't up to me, it's up to the bosses.
Is that
Lou? Lou and Mel, yeah.
Okay, right. Well, I think we've reached our quota for the evening, as in time-wise, but we don't need to rush off, so do get your book signed by Erin and chat to her a little further. But thank you so much for all you've shared. It's been
thank you for
having
fantastic,
me.
Thank
you. All you've given us tonight. So shall we give a round of applause?